He, the same one that graced the cover of People against my wishes. He's there, too. His image is in a separate box right next to mine. I haven't seen that face in 10 years. Not since that night. I shut my eyes, but it's too late. That single glimpse breaks something loose inside me, not far from where his knife went in. A croak belches from my throat, followed by a sick rattling as that broken chunk of myself pushes upward, black and bilious and thick. I'm going to throw up, I warn. And so I do, spewing onto the floor until every single article there is covered.
Pine Cottage, 6:18 p.m. Quincy and Janelle stood in the cabin's kitchen area, separated from the great room by a waist-high counter. It was Janelle's suggestion that each of them prepare some aspect of dinner. A surprise, seeing as how the most elaborate thing Quincy had ever seen her cook was ramen noodles. Maybe we should just roast hot dogs, Quincy had said when they were planning the weekend. We're camping, after all. Hot dogs? Janelle replied, affronted. Not on my birthday. So there they were, colliding with Amy and Betts, who had been tasked with the main course of roast chicken and several side dishes. Quincy was on cake duty, and she had lugged along an entire bag of baking tools to use for the occasion. A cake pan, all the necessary ingredients, an icing bag with detachable tips. Yes, Janelle's mother and stepfather had paid for the cabin rental, but Quincy was determined to earn her keep in cake. Janelle had an easy job, bartender. While Betts and Amy fussed with the chicken and Quincy decorated the cake, she set out several bottles of liquor. The large, cheap kind that came in plastic jugs and was meant to be poured into red Solo cups, of which Janelle had brought plenty. How long are you going to let Joe stay? Quincy whispered to her. As long as he likes, Janelle whispered back. Like, all night? Seriously? Sure, Janelle said. It's getting late and there's plenty of room. It could be fun. Quincy disagreed. So did everyone else in their own muted way. Even Joe, with his odd cadences and filthy glasses that clouded his eyes, seemed unenthused by the idea. "Has it occurred to you that Joe might want to go home?" Quincy said. "Isn't that right, Joe?" Their unexpected guest sat on the threadbare couch in the great room, watching Craig and Rodney kneel in front of the cavernous fireplace and bicker over the best way to start a fire. Realizing he was being addressed, he looked Quincy's way, startled.
"I don't want to be a bother," he said.
"It's no bother," Janelle assured him. "Unless you have somewhere you need to be."
"I don't."
"And you're hungry, right?" Joe shrugged.
"I guess."
"We've got plenty of food and drink. Plus, we have a couch, not to mention an extra bed."
"We also have a car," Quincy said. "Full of cell phones. Craig could call a tow truck or drive him anywhere he needs to go. You know, like back to his own car or his house, which will take hours. Besides, maybe Joe wants to join the party." Janelle looked his way, hoping he'd second that thought. "Now that we're all friends." "Technically, he's still a stranger," Quincy said.
Janelle flashed the exasperated look she always got when she thought Quincy was being a goody-goody. Quincy had seen that same expression before her only sip of beer and her single hit of a joint. In both instances, Janelle had used sheer force of will to coax her into doing something she didn't want to do. Now, though, her frustration was amplified by the situation. Everything about the weekend, the cabin, her birthday, the absence of oversight of any kind, made her slightly manic. "We're here to have fun, right?" she said.
There was something accusing about the way she said it, as if she suspected she was the only one there intent on a good time. So let's have fun. That seemed to settle it. Joe would be staying as long as he liked. The birthday girl again got her wish. What's your poison? Janelle asked Joe once the makeshift bar was complete. He blinked at the bottles, alternately confused and dazzled by the choices.
I don't really drink.
Seriously? Janelle said. Like, not at all?
Yes.
He frowned.
I mean, no.
Well, which is it?
Maybe he doesn't want to drink, Quincy said. Again, the voice of reason, the angel perpetually perched on Janelle's shoulder.
Maybe, like me, Joe prefers to maintain control over his mental faculties. You don't drink because you're a wuss, and Mommy and Daddy would get mad if they ever found out, Janelle told her. Joe's not like that. Isn't that right?
It's just, I've never tried it,
Joe said. Not even with your friends? Joe stammered, trying to push out a response, but it was too late. Janelle pounced. What? No friends either?
I have friends,
Joe said, a prickle in his voice. A girlfriend? Janelle asked, teasing.
Maybe. I don't know what she is.
Behind Quincy, Betts whispered, Imaginary is my guess. Janelle glared at her before turning back to Joe, saying, Then you'll have quite a story to tell the next time you see her. She began to pour, splashing liquor from several bottles into a cup and filling it the rest of the way with orange juice. She took the cup to Joe, forcing his fingers around the red plastic. Drink up. Joe tipped his face toward the cup instead of the other way around, his nose dipping bird-like beneath the rim. A cough rose from inside the cup. His first sip. When he came up for air, his eyes were wide and goofy.
It's okay,
he said. Okay? You totally love it, Janelle replied. Joe smacked his lips.
It's too sweet.
I can fix that. Janelle grabbed the cup from his hands as quickly as she had put it into them. Then she was back at the bar, snatching a lemon and searching her work area. Does anyone have a knife? She spotted one on the counter, a carving knife intended for the chicken Amy and Betts were preparing. Grabbing it, Janelle pushed it into the lemon, slicing through peel, pulp, and, ultimately, her finger.
Damn it!
At first, Quincy thought she was being dramatic for Joe's sake, giving him what the rest of them had dubbed the Janelle Show behind her back. But then she saw the blood pumping from Janelle's finger, spilling over the paper napkin pressed against it, littering the counter in drops the size of rose petals.
Ow, Janelle whimpered, tears forming. Ouch, owie, ow.
Quincy swooped in behind her, cooing, performing her roommate-appointed duty to soothe.
It'll be okay. Lift your hand. Put pressure on it.
She flailed around the kitchen, searching for a first aid kit, while Janelle hopped from foot to foot, wincing at the sight of all that blood.
Hurry,
she urged. Quincy found a tin of Band-Aids beneath the sink. The old-fashioned kind, with a hinged, flip-top lid. So old she couldn't remember the last time she had a similar pack in her own house. She grabbed the biggest Band-Aid she could find and wrapped it around Janelle's finger, begging her to hold still.
All done,
Quincy said, backing away, hands raised. You're good as new. The drama lured Joe off the couch. He hovered nearby, watching Janelle examine her bandaged finger. He lowered his gaze to the knife on the counter and its blood-splotched blade.
That looks sharp,
he said, picking up the knife and touching the pad of his index finger against its tip. You need to be more careful.
He stared at Janelle and Quincy, as if seeking assurances that they would be. Beads of liquid clung to his bottom lip, remnants of his first cocktail. He wiped them away with the back of his hand, and, knife still in his grip, licked his lips.
13. Jeff retrieves me a half hour later, summoned by Jonah Thompson, who found his number on my cell phone, which I handed to him when he asked me the name of an emergency contact person shortly after I puked all over his shoes. I'm in the lobby ladies' room when he arrives, hunched over a toilet, even though my stomach feels as squeezed dry as an empty water bottle. It's up to one of Jonah's co-workers to fetch me from the stall. A tiny bird of a reporter named Emily, who nervously calls to me from just inside the door like I'm someone contagious, someone to be feared. Back at the apartment, Jeff puts me to bed in spite of protests that I'm feeling much better. Apparently I'm not, for I'm asleep as soon as my head hits the pillow. I sleep fitfully for the rest of the afternoon, only vaguely aware of either Jeff or Sam popping into the bedroom to check on me. By evening, I'm wide awake and famished. Jeff brings in a tray of food fit for an invalid: chicken noodle soup, toast, and ginger ale. "It's not the flu, you know," I tell him. "You don't know that for sure," Jeff says. "It sounds like you were pretty sick." From a combination of lack of sleep and wild turkey and so many Xanax. And him, of course. Seeing that picture of him. "It must have been something I ate," I say. "I'm much better now. Honest, I'm fine." "Then I'm sure you'll be happy to know that your mother called," I groan. "She said the neighbors are asking why you're on the front page of the newspapers," Jeff continues. "One newspaper," I say. "She wants to know what to tell them." "Of course she does." Jeff snags a triangle of toast, takes a bite, puts it back on my tray. While chewing, he says, "It wouldn't hurt to call her back." "And have her berate me for not being perfect?" I say. "I think I'll pass." "She's concerned about you, hon. It's been an eventful few days. Lisa's suicide, being in that newspaper. Sam and I are worried about how you're dealing with it all." "Does this mean the two of you actually had a conversation?" "We did," Jeff says. "And it was civil?" "Abundantly." "Color me surprised. What did the two of you talk about?" Jeff reaches again for the toast, but I swat his hand away. He instead kicks off his shoes and pulls his legs onto the bed. On his side now, he scoots close, his body pressing against the entire length of my own. "You. And how it might be a good idea to have Sam stick around for a week." "Wow. Who are you and what have you done with the real Jefferson Richards?" "I'm serious," Jeff says. "I spent all day thinking about what you said last night. And you're right. The way I got those charges against Sam dropped was wrong. She deserved a better defense. And I'm sorry." I hand Jeff more toast. "Apology accepted. Plus," he says between bites, "this cop-killing case is going to start taking up more of my time, and I don't like the idea of you being home alone most of the day. Not after your picture's been plastered all over the city." "So you're suggesting that Sam becomes my babysitter?" "Companion," Jeff says. "And she's actually the one who suggested it. She mentioned the two of you did some baking together yesterday. It might be nice to have some help during baking season. You always said you wanted an assistant." "Are you sure about this?" I ask. "It's a lot for you to handle."
Jeff tilts his head at me. "You sound like you're not sure."
"I think it's a great idea. I just don't want it to affect you or us."
"Listen.
I'm going to be honest here and admit that Sam and I will probably never be friends. But the two of you have a connection. Or you could. I know we don't talk much about what happened to you. Because there's no need to, I hastily add. I agree, Jeff says. You say you'll never get past what happened, but you already have. You're not that girl anymore. You're Quincy Carpenter, baking goddess. Whatever, I say, although the description secretly pleases me. But maybe you do need some kind of support system to cope. Someone other than Coop. If Sam's that person you need, I don't want to stand in the way of it. I realize, not for the first time, how lucky I am to have landed someone like Jeff. I can't help but think he's the one big difference between Sam and me. Without him, I'd be just like her. Wild and angry and lonesome. A tempest never reaching shore, forever tossing about. You're awesome, I say, pushing the tray aside to throw myself on top of him. I kiss him. He kisses back, pulling me tighter against him. The stress of the day suddenly melts into desire, and I find myself undressing him without even thinking about it. Loosening the tie still knotted around his neck, popping open the buttons of his Oxford shirt, kissing the rosy nipples surrounded by a thicket of hair before moving lower and feeling his arousal. My phone buzzes on the nightstand. I try to ignore it, thinking it's a reporter, or worse, my mother. Yet the phone continues to rattle against the bedside lamp, insistent. I check the caller ID. It's Coop, I say. Jeff sighs, his desire deflating. Can't it wait? It can't. Coop had called me yesterday evening, responding to my pretending not to be worried text. At the time, I was too busy to answer, what with Sam hovering around me in the kitchen while I made dinner. If I don't pick up now, he'll definitely be concerned. Not while my picture is still on the front page, I tell Jeff. Vibrating phone in hand, I spring out of bed and hurry into the master bathroom, closing the door behind me.
Why didn't you tell me Samantha Boyd contacted you?
Coop says by way of greeting. How did you find out?
I got a Google alert, he says.
The answer so unexpected he could have told me aliens and I wouldn't have been more surprised,
although I would have preferred to hear it from you.
I was going to call you, I say, which is the truth. I had planned to call him right after I got done confronting Jonah. Sam showed up at my place yesterday. After Lisa's death, she thought it would be a good idea if we met. I could have told Coop more than that, of course. How Sam had changed her name years ago. How she dared me into downing two Xanax too many. How I threw all three back up the moment I saw his picture.
Is she still there?
Coop asks. Yes, she's going to be staying with us.
How long?
I don't know. Until she figures out some stuff.
Do you really think that's a good idea?
Why? You worried about me?
I always worry about you, Quincy.
I pause, unsure how to respond. Coop's never been this forthright before. I don't know if it's a good change or a bad one. Either way, it's nice to hear him admit out loud that he cares. It's definitely more heartwarming than a nod. Admit it, I finally say. When you saw that Google alert, you almost drove out here to check on me.
I got as far as the end of the driveway before stopping myself, Coop replies.
I don't doubt him. It's that kind of devotion that's made me feel safe all these years. What changed your mind?
Knowing that you can take care of yourself.
So I've been told.
But I'm still concerned that Samantha Boyd has come out of hiding, Coop says. You have to admit, it's startling.
You're starting to sound like Jeff.
What's she like? Is she...
The first words I think of are the same ones Sam used this morning.
damaged goods. Instead, I say, normal? Considering what happened to her, she's as normal as anyone can be. But not as normal as you. I detect a smile in his voice. I imagine his blue eyes sparkling, which happens on the rare occasions he actually lets down his guard. Of course not, I say. I'm the queen of normalcy.
Well, Queen Quincy, what do you think about me coming into the city to meet Samantha? I'd like to get a read on her.
Why?
Because I don't trust her.
Coop softens his tone slightly, as if he knows he's starting to sound too intense.
Not until I meet her myself. I want to make sure she's not up to something.
She's not, I say. Jeff's already grilled her.
Well, I haven't.
I'd hate to put you out like that.
You wouldn't be, Coop says. I have the day off and the weather is nice. The leaves are starting to turn in the Poconos. Makes for a pretty drive.
Then sure, I say. How does noon sound?
Perfect.
Even though we're on the phone, I know Coop is nodding. I can sense it.
The usual place.
It's a date, I say. Coop grows serious again, his voice husky and low.
Just please be careful until then. I know you think I'm being overly concerned, but I'm not. She's a stranger, Quincy. One who experienced a whole lot of bad stuff. We don't know if it messed her up. We don't know what she's capable of.
I sit on the edge of the bathtub, knees pressed together, suddenly cold. Jonah Thompson's voice flashes into my thoughts.
It's about Samantha Boyd. She's lying to you.
What a spineless asshole. Don't worry, I tell Coop. I think you'll like her. We say our goodbyes, Coop finishing up with his usual invitation to call or text if I need anything. At the sink, I splash water onto my face and gargle with a hearty dose of mouthwash. I pout at my reflection, trying to look sexy, mentally preparing myself to pick up where Jeff and I left off. Despite Coop's interruption, the desire I felt earlier is still very much intact. Perhaps even more so. I'm fully ready to jump back into bed and finish what I started with Jeff. But when I exit the bathroom, I see that Jeff, tired of waiting and just plain tired, has fallen fast asleep. Midnight finds my mind exhausted but my body wide awake. All that napping earlier in the afternoon has left me thrumming with energy. I shift and roll beneath the covers, too warm with them, too cold without them. Jeff has no such problem. He snores lightly beside me, lost to the world. Rather than remain in bed, I get up and change into jeans, a t-shirt, and a cardigan. A little late-night baking feels in order. Old-fashioned apple dumplings. The next item on the Quincy sweet schedule, which has already been thrown off by a day. I don't get past the guest room. Sam's room now, I suppose. A strip of light creeps from beneath the door, so I give it a single, tentative tap.
It's open, Sam says.
I find her in the corner, rooting through the knapsack. She pulls out the earrings from Saks and tosses them onto the bed, their presence jarring my memory. I had forgotten all about them.
I took the stuff out of your purse when you got home, she tells me, in case Jeff decided to look in there.
Thanks, I say, staring glumly at the earrings. I'm not sure I want them anymore.
I'll take them.
Sam grabs the earrings off the bed and drops them back into the knapsack.
It's not like we can return them.
How are you feeling?
Better,
I say. But now I can't sleep.
Sleeping's not my strong suit either.
Jeff told me about your talk earlier today, I say. And I'm happy. We're happy. To have you here, I mean. Just yell if you need anything. Make yourself at home. Which she's already done. A couple of books sit on the nightstand. Dog-eared science fiction paperbacks and a hardcover copy of The Art of War. Although the window is open, it can't quite erase the cigarette smoke clinging to the air. Sam's leather purse ashtray rests on the sill. "I'm sorry I left you alone the rest of the day," I say. "I hope you weren't too bored." "It's cool." Sam sits on one side of the bed, patting the mattress until I settle onto the other. "I took a walk around the neighborhood. Had that nice talk with Jeff." "I'll make it up to you tomorrow," I tell her. "Which reminds me, we're meeting someone tomorrow. His name is Franklin Cooper."
"The cop who saved your life?"
I'm surprised she knows who he is. She really has been keeping tabs on me. "Right," I say. "He wants to meet you. Say hi."
"And see if I'm a psycho," Sam says.
"Don't worry, I get it.
He needs to see if I can be trusted."
I clear my throat, which means you can't mention the Xanax.
"Sure," Sam says. "Or the 5-fingered discount you sometimes take advantage of."
"Yes," I reply, grateful I don't have to say it out loud. "That too."
"I'll be on my best behavior," Sam says. "I won't even swear."
After that, we'll play tourist. The Empire State Building, Rockefeller Center, wherever you want to go.
Central Park?
I can't tell if she's attempting a joke about what happened the night before.
"If you'd like." "Why wait? Why not go right now?"
Now I know she's joking. "That's so not a good idea," I say.
"And was puking on that reporter a good idea?"
"That wasn't intentional."
"Did he say anything?"
Once more, Jonah Thompson's insistent voice tiptoes into my skull. Again, I ignore it. The only thing Sam lied about was her name change, and I know all about that now. Jonah's the one who was lying, trying to get me to spill my guts about being called a final girl. I spilled my guts, just not in the way he was expecting. "Nothing important," I say. "I wasn't there to listen. I went there to yell."
"Good for you."
Another thought occurs to me, making my voice go soft. "Why didn't you go with me? Why didn't you even want me to go?"
"Because you need to pick your battles," Sam says. "I learned a long time ago that fighting with the press is useless. They'll win every time. And with guys like that Jonah Thompson punk, it only eggs him on. We'll probably be in the paper again tomorrow."
The thought makes my body go rigid with fear. "I'm sorry if that happens."
"It's no big deal. I'm just happy you finally got mad about something."
A spark ignites just behind her eyes.
"How did it feel to confront him?"
I think about it for a moment, parsing through my hazy memory, trying to sort how I really felt from what the Xanax made me feel. I think I liked it. Scratch that. I know I liked it. I felt righteous and energized and strong, right up until the nausea took over. "It felt good," I say.
"Getting angry always does. And are you still mad?"
"No," I say.
Sam gives me a playful shove from across the bed. "Liar."
"Fine, yes, I'm still mad."
The question then becomes, what are you going to do about it?
"Nothing," I say.
"You just said it's useless to fight with the press." "I'm not talking about the press now. I'm talking about life. The world. It's full of misfortune and unfairness, and women like us getting hurt by men who should know better. And very few people actually give a shit. Even fewer of us actually get angry and take action."
"But you're one of them," I say.
"Damn right. You want to join me?"
I stare across the bed at Sam and the fiery glint crackling in her eyes. My heartbeat increases a tick or two as something stirs in my chest, as light as a butterfly's wings scraping the inside of its chrysalis. It's longing, I realize. A longing to feel the same way I felt with Sam that morning. A longing to be radiant. I don't know, I say. Maybe. Sam grabs her jacket, shoves it on, closes it with a forceful zip. Then let's go. 14. I can handle this. That's what I tell myself. We're only going to Central Park, for God's sake. Not a forest in the middle of nowhere. I have my pepper spray. I have Sam. We'll be fine. But doubt takes over as soon as we step outside. The night air is shockingly cold. I rub my arms for warmth as Sam lights a cigarette beneath the building's awning. Then we're off, my heartbeat racing as we cross Columbus Avenue, Sam ahead of me, trailing smoke. When we reach Central Park West, my anxiety only increases. The wrongness of the situation is obvious. I feel it in my gut, as if my conscience is an internal organ, crimson and fleshy, flaring with unexplained distress. We shouldn't be out here. Not at this hour. I had wanted to feel radiant again. Instead, I feel dim and hollow and small. I think we've gone far enough. My voice gets lost in the chilly breeze. Not that Sam would have turned back had she heard me. She's all determination as she crosses the street and makes a right, heading toward the park entrance one block south. I break into a run, following the route of my morning jogs, until I've caught up to her. What are we going to do out here? I say. You'll see. Sam ditches her cigarette and veers into the park. I pause at the threshold, the headlights cruising up Central Park West catching me in their glare and bending my shadow over the sidewalk. I want to turn back. I almost do. My body's prepared to sprint to the apartment and dive into bed, clinging to Jeff. But I can no longer see Sam. She's been swallowed by the park's dark mouth. Sam? I say. Come back! There's no response. I wait, hoping she'll reappear, grinning, saying this is just another one of her tests, one that I have failed. But when she doesn't come back, my nervousness ticks up another notch. Sam's alone in the park, in the dead of night. And even though I know she can take care of herself, I worry. So I curl my fingers around the slim canister of pepper spray in my pocket. I curse myself for not taking a Xanax. Then I inhale a deep, jittery breath and step into the park. Sam stands just beyond the entrance. Not lost, just blending with the shadows as she waits for me to catch up. She looks impatient, or annoyed. I can't quite tell. Come on, she says, grabbing my arm and pulling me along. I know this part of the park well. I've been here 1,000 times. The Diana Ross playground is to our left, its gates closed and locked. On our right sits the exit curve of the 79th Street transverse. Yet night has transformed the park into something forbidden and unfamiliar. I barely recognize it. A mist has rolled in, shivery and thick. It whispers against my skin and halos the lamps along the path, diffusing their glow. Muted circles of light creep across the grass and get tangled in the trees, making the park's woods seem thicker. More wild. I try not to think about the woods surrounding Pine Cottage, even though it's all I can think about. That thick forest filled with hidden dangers. It's like I'm back there again, ready to break out into my life-or-death race through the trees. Sam heads deeper into the park. I follow, even as a chant of worry forms in my thoughts. This is dangerous. Wrong. Through the mist, I see the hazy outline of the Delacorte Theater. Just beyond it is Belvedere Castle, a miniature fortress rising from a rock outcropping. Its fog-shrouded silhouette brings to mind fairy tale forests. One could get lost in a place like this, I think. One could stray from the path and never be seen again. Just like Janelle. Like all of them. For now, Sam and I keep on the path as we head south, staying close to the park's western border. Despite the hour, we are not alone. I glimpse other people, moving shadows in the distance. A couple crossing the park swiftly, heads lowered against the mist. A late-night jogger behind us, breath heavy, tinny music drifting out of earbuds. Their appearances make my heart crash like cymbals. Then there are the solitary men with fog-blurred faces who cruise the park's paths, looking for the erotic thrill of illicit, anonymous sex. Many of them wear similar clothes, as if there's a dress code involved. Track pants and expensive running shoes. Hooded sweatshirts unzipped to expose tight t-shirts. They emerge from the mist in all directions, roaming, circling, searching. They don't give Sam and me a second glance. We're not their type. "We should go back," I say. "Chill," Sam says. She shares the same restlessness as those discreetly prowling men. There's something driving her. A hunger, a need. She plops onto a bench, her right leg fidgeting as she searches the horizon. A hardness has replaced the earlier fire in her eyes, her stare cold and coal-black. I sit beside her, my heart beating so hard I'm surprised it doesn't shake the bench. Sam digs a cigarette out of her jacket pocket and lights up. The flare of her lighter in the fog gets the attention of one of the prowlers, a leather-clad moth drawn to the flame. I tense up as he gets closer. My hand tightens around the pepper spray in my pocket. Once he reaches our bench, his features clear. He's handsome and lithe, with a peppery stubble tracing the line of his jaw. An air of dark sexiness radiates off him. "Hey," he says, voice hushed and apologetic, as if talking isn't allowed. "Can I bum a smoke?" Sam obliges, slipping a cigarette from her pocket and into his palm with the ease of a dime bag dealer. She flicks her lighter and the man leans forward, cigarette tip catching, glowing hot a moment before darkening into a smolder. He nods at Sam, blowing out smoke that mingles with the mist. "Thanks." "No prob," Sam says. "Good luck tonight." The man smiles, sly and sexy. He begins to walk away in a leather-clad strut, saying over his shoulder, "Luck has nothing to do with it, sweetie." Then he's gone, vanishing back into the fog from which he emerged. I think about him, in a different woods, in a different time. If only he had disappeared like that, slipping away, leaving us alone. "Sam, I want to go home," I say. "Fine," Sam replies. "Go." "You're not coming with me?"
"Nope."
"What are we doing here?"
Sam shushes me, suddenly alert. She stands, looking in the direction we just came from, body taut, poised, ready to pounce. I follow her gaze, seeing what she sees. A woman has appeared in the mist, roughly 100 yards away. Alone, she hurries through the park with an unwieldy canvas tote held tight against her chest. Young and hungry, probably. Crossing the park on foot to save on cab fare, not thinking about how spectacularly bad an idea that really is. A man emerges from the fog right behind her, so close he could be her shadow. Shrouded in a black hoodie, he even looks like a shadow. He moves at a steady clip, faster than the girl, gaining on her. She realizes this and quickens her pace, on the cusp of a run. "Sam?" I say, as my heart begins to thud hollowly in my chest.
Do you think he's going to mug her? Or...
worse. That's what I'm about to say.
Or worse.
I don't get the chance, because the half-man, half-shadow is already upon the girl, a hand clamping down on her shoulder, the other reaching for either the tote bag or her breasts hidden behind it. Sam takes off, sprinting up the path, the sound of her boots muffled in the haze. Instinct makes me run after her, even though I only vaguely know what's about to happen. Up ahead, the girl sees Sam and recoils, as if Sam is aiming for her. She struggles under the man's grip, legs unsteady, the tote bag raised like a shield in front of her. Sam passes her in a wide arc, heading instead for the man, not slowing, smashing right into him. The collision knocks him away from the girl and into the grass. Sam bounces off him, staggering backward. The girl hurtles away, wanting to look back but too scared to. I leap in front of her, hands raised, adrenaline frothing inside me. "Friends," I say, "we're friends." Behind her, the assailant slips over the grass as he tries to flee. Sam hurls herself at him, leaping onto his back. Quickly, I guide the almost victim to the closest bench, set her down, order her to stay there. Then I'm off, rushing toward Sam. Somehow, she's pushed the man onto his knees. He slumps more the longer she's on top of him, bending so far forward his face brushes the grass. Something Coop said earlier fills my skull. We don't know what she's capable of.
Sam, don't hurt him!
My voice cuts across the park, distracting Sam. She looks up. Not long, just a split second. But it's enough time for the man to kick at her. His foot hits her in the stomach and sends her rolling through the grass. The man rises in a lunge, legs spaced apart and bent at the knees. A sprinter at the starting line. Soon he's off, shoes slipping a bit on the slick grass. Sam still on her back, trying to flip onto her side, sucking in air to cool the pain in her stomach. Not down for the count, but close enough. I break into a run, awkwardly, with one hand in my pocket fumbling for the pepper spray. The man is completely up now, also running. But I'm faster, all those jogged miles paying off. I catch the man's sweatshirt, jerking the hood off his head. There's a baseball cap underneath, slightly askew. I see a shock of raven black hair, cocoa skin on the back of his neck. One hard pull of the hood is all it takes to slow him down, sneakers sliding, arms flailing. When he whirls around, I expect to see his face. Instead, all I see is the blur of his hand as it streaks toward me. Then the slap comes. A brutal backhand whipping my cheek so hard, my entire head jerks to the right. My vision clouds with a red pulse of pain that blocks out everything else. I haven't felt pain like that in years. 10 years, to be precise. Fleeing Pine Cottage, screaming through the woods, that thick branch knocking me dizzy. Suddenly it's like I'm right back there again, feeling the deep throbbing hurt from that branch. Time contracts, becoming a dark tunnel that I'm about to fall through, not landing until I've returned to that cursed woods where all those bad things happened. But I don't. I'm back in the present, shock numbing my body. I let go of the hood, my hand opening against my will. I can still see the man through the red haze clouding my vision. Now free, he's running south, getting farther away. Soon gone. His presence is replaced by two others, swooping in from different directions. One of them is Sam, hurrying up behind me, saying my name. The other is the girl we just saved. She's left her bench and comes toward me, hand deep in her tote bag.
"You're bleeding," she says.
I press a hand to my nose as something hot and wet trickles from my nostrils. Looking down, I see blood glistening on my fingers. The girl hands me a tissue. While I dab at my nose, Sam presses against my back, encircling me with a hug.
God damn, babe, she says. We've got a fighter on our hands. I breathe through my mouth, swallowing crisp air that smells faintly of grass. My entire body hums with a mixture of adrenaline and fear and pride that Sam might actually be right. I am a fighter, aglow with radiance. The girl we saved, she never does give us her name, also seems astonished. She speaks in odd, hushed tones as we whisk through the fog on our way out of the park, asking us if we're vigilantes. No, I say. Yes, Sam says. Once we're on Central Park West, I hail a cab and make sure the girl actually gets into it. Before closing the door, I shove a 20 into her palm, closing her fingers over the bill and saying, Cab fare. Don't ever walk through the park alone this late again. 15. My face still hurts when I wake up. A dull residual pain that trails along my cheekbone to my nose. In the shower, I make the water as hot as I can endure and spend a good 5 minutes sniffing steam into my nose, huffing it out, dislodging the dried blood caked to the insides of my nostrils. I then lift my face to the spray, the hot water stinging my skin. When I think about last night, a tremor grips my legs so violently that I have to lean against the shower wall for support. It's hard to believe I was that foolish, that quick to leap into danger. The man in the park could have been armed. I could have been stabbed, shot, killed. All things considered, I'm lucky I got away with a mere backhand to the face. Out of the shower, I swipe my hand over the bathroom mirror, making a clear streak across the fogged surface. The reflection staring back at me has the faintest of bruises on her cheek, barely noticeable. Yet it's tender to the touch. A little pressure from my fingertips is enough to make me wince. The new pain along my cheek has awakened older wounds. Although the stab wounds I received at Pine Cottage didn't cause any lasting damage, they did leave scars. Today they're throbbing. The first time I've felt them in years. I arch my back slightly until the scar on my stomach is framed in the mirror. A milk-white line against my steam-reddened skin. I then lean forward, looking close at the two scars sitting an inch apart just below my shoulder. One is a vertical line, the other slightly diagonal. Had the knife been bigger, the two would have intersected. By the time I'm dried off and dressed, everything has subsided into a slight ache. Annoying, yes, but nothing I can't handle. In the kitchen, I take my pre-coup Xanax and grape soda, waiting for Sam to emerge from her room. She does a few minutes later, looking like a completely different person. Her hair is swept behind her ears, giving full view of a face that's been gently kissed with makeup. The eyeliner has been applied with a lighter hand, and instead of ruby red, her lips are touched with a peachy pink gloss. Forgoing her usual black, she's dressed in dark jeans, blue flats, and the very same blouse she had taken from Saks yesterday. The gold earrings I stole dangle from her ears. Wow, I say. Not bad for a chick my age, right? I'll say. I wanted to make a good impression. While walking to the cafe, we catch a few looks from passers-by, although it's impossible to know whether they're because of Jonah Thompson's article or Sam's new look. Probably the latter. Few eyes, I notice, glance my way, and when they do, it feels like they're comparing me with Sam. Even Coop does it when we arrive at the cafe and pass his usual spot by the window. Through the glass, I see a brief nod for me and an appraising look directed at Sam. A pinprick of irritation forms at the back of my neck. Coop stands when we enter. Unlike our last meeting, he's dressed to blend in with the cafe's upper-class crowd. Today he wears khakis and a black polo shirt. It looks good on him, the short sleeves exposing his taut biceps, the veins popping just beneath his skin.
"You must be Samantha," he says.
He's slow with the handshake, awkward, uncertain. It's up to Sam to complete the gesture, reaching across the table to grasp his open palm.
"And you're Officer Cooper," she says.
"Coop," he says quickly. "Everyone calls me Coop."
"And everyone calls me Sam."
"Great," I say, forcing a smile as we take our seats. "We're all acquainted." Two mugs sit on the table in front of Coop. His coffee and my tea. Looking at them, he says,
"I wanted to order something for you, Sam, but I didn't know what you prefer."
"Coffee," Sam says, "and I can get it. You two catch up."
She edges around tables to the counter in the back of the cafe. One of them is occupied by a bearded guy wearing a backward baseball cap. A writer, judging from the laptop in front of him. Elsewhere on the table are a leather satchel, an iPhone, and a shiny Montblanc pen sitting atop a yellow legal pad. He looks at Sam as she passes, impressed. Sam smiles at him, wiggling her fingers in a flirtatious wave.
"So that's Samantha Boyd," Coop says.
"In the flesh."
I gaze at him over the table, watching him watch Sam on the other side of the cafe.
"Is something wrong?"
"I'm just shocked, is all," he says. "I never expected her to show up like this. It's kind of like seeing a ghost."
"I was surprised, too."
"She's not what I was expecting."
"What were you expecting?"
"Someone rougher, I guess. She looked different in that yearbook photo, don't you think?"
I could tell Coop that Sam is very different, that she's smoothed down her rough edges to impress him for my sake. I stay silent.
"I did some reading about the Nightlight Inn last night," Coop says. "I can't imagine what she's been through."
"She's had a hard life," I say.
"How are the two of you getting along?"
"Great. She and Jeff don't exactly see eye to eye."
Coop allows a half smile.
"I can't say that surprises me."
"Jeff's the one you should be getting to know. This arrangement with Sam is only temporary. Like it or not, Jeff's permanent." I don't know why I say it. It slips out, unplanned. And just like that, Coop's fraction of a smile vanishes.
"But thank you for coming," I say, guilt softening my tone. "It was nice of you to suggest it, even though I'm starting to feel like a burden."
"You're not a burden, Quincy. You've never been one, and you'll never be one."
Coop stares at me with those eyes of his. I run a finger over my bruised face, wondering if he somehow noticed that imperceptible line of pink along my cheekbone. Part of me hopes he'll ask about it, allowing me to use the lie I concocted to explain it away.
"Oh, that? I bumped into a doorway."
I'm disappointed when he looks over my shoulder, watching Sam make her way back to us with a steaming mug in her hands. When she passes the writer again, she accidentally bumps the table, coffee mug tilting precariously.
"I'm so sorry,"
she yelps. The man looks up, smiling.
"No problem."
"Nice laptop," she says.
Soon she's at our table again, sitting beside me, giving Coop the once-over before telling him,
"I thought you'd look different."
"Good different or bad different?" Coop asks.
"Ugly different, and clearly you're not."
"So you knew who I was before today?"
"Of course," Sam says, "just like you knew who I was. That's the power of the internet. No one has secrets anymore."
"Is that why you went into hiding?"
"Mostly," Sam says, "but now I'm back among the living."
"You certainly are."
There's an edge of disbelief in Coop's voice, as if he's not buying the good girl act Sam's pushing so hard. He leans back, tilts his head, sizes her up the same way she did him.
"Why'd you decide to return?"
"After I heard about what happened to Lisa, I thought I could possibly help Quincy," Sam says, adding,
if she needed help.
Quincy doesn't need help.
Coop says it like I'm not sitting directly across from him. Like I'm invisible.
She's strong like that.
But I didn't know that, Sam says, which is why I'm here.
Are you going to stay long?
Sam gives a blithe shrug. Maybe. It's too soon to tell. I take a sip of tea. It's too hot, the liquid burning my tongue. But I keep drinking in the hope the pain will erase the spot of annoyance that's once again found its way onto the back of my neck. This time it's the size of a thumbprint pressing into my skin. Sam changed her name, I say. That's why no one's been able to locate her.
Really?
Coop's features rise in surprise. I'm expecting a lecture similar to the one he gave me when I suggested changing my name. Instead, he says,
I'm not going to ask you where you were or what name you were living under. I hope that, in time, you'll trust me enough to tell me that on your own. All I ask is that you contact your family and let them know.
My family is one of the reasons I disappeared, Sam says, growing quiet. It wasn't exactly the best environment, even before the night light in. It just got worse after. I love them and all, but some families aren't meant to be around each other.
I could contact them for you, Coop suggests, just to tell them you're safe.
I couldn't ask you to do that.
Coop shrugs. You didn't. I offered.
Spoken like a true public servant, Sam says. Were you always a cop?
Not always. Before that, I was in the military. Marines.
You see any action?
Some.
Coop looks out the window, fixing those baby blues on the outside world to avoid eye contact.
Afghanistan.
Shit, Sam says. You must have seen some messed up stuff.
I did. But I don't like to talk about it.
Well, you and Quincy certainly have that in common. Coop turns away from the window, facing not Sam, but me. Again, there's something unreadable in his expression. He looks suddenly, terribly sad.
People deal with trauma in their own ways, he says.
And how do you deal with yours? Sam asks.
I fish, Coop says, and hunt, and hike. You know, typical Pennsylvania boy stuff.
Does it help?
Mostly.
Maybe I should try it, Sam says.
I'd be happy to take you and Quincy fishing sometime, if you'd like.
Quincy's right. You really are the best. Sam reaches across the table and squeezes Coop's hand. He doesn't pull away. My irritation grows. Tension fills my shoulders and pokes through the soft cushion of Xanax. I want to take a second pill. I worry that I've now become the kind of woman who needs to take a second pill. I have to go to the ladies' room, I say, grabbing my purse off the table. Join me, Sam?
Sure.
Sam gives Coop a wink. Girls, we're so predictable, right? On our way to the back of the cafe, she gives another wave to the writer at the table. He waves back. Sam and I then cram ourselves into a bathroom built to accommodate only one person. We stand in front of the dust-mottled mirror, shoulders touching. How am I doing? Sam says as she checks her makeup. The question is, what are you doing? Being friendly. Isn't that what you wanted? It is. Then what's the problem? Just tone it down a little, I say. If you come on too strong, Coop will know it's an act.
Would that be a problem if he does?
It could make things awkward.
I don't mind awkward, Sam says.
I start to root through my purse, looking for any stray Xanax that might be resting inside. Coop does. Oh, Sam says, the word a pool of innuendo. So things have gotten awkward between you two.
He's a friend, I say.
Right, a friend.
He is.
At the bottom of my purse, I find...